What's going down, everybody? Welcome to Show Me the Meaning, Wisecracks Movie Podcast.
Show me the Texas Midlands receipt.
That is right. Yeehaw, motherfuckers. What's up? I'm Austin Hayden. I'm joined by the Show Me the Meaning crew. We've got Raymond.
Hello.
And joining us once again, we've got Michael O'Burns.
What's up, y'all?
Have you stopped going? Wasn't there a time when you went by your Irishized version of your name?
You know, digitally I did, but not in pronunciation in person. I got a little dramatic once and said, so people might not know this. Guy Fieri's birth name is Guy Fieri, but he found out that his grandpa had to change his name at Ellis Island. When he got married to honor his Italian heritage, he changed it to Fieri. And I, for a while, was saying, when I get married, I'm going to go back to the Gaelic version of my family name as an affront to the queen and everything she stands for. No one else wanted me to do it. So, you know, but spiritually, I feel that way.
I thought you were going to say, in order to honor his family, Guy Fieri married his cousin.
No, that too. He absolutely married his cousin. But that was a separate thing. No, I'm kidding. I should never say that. He's a lovely wife, great kids, hunter and rider. And I would never want to speak ill of them.
And I was going to say, fun fact, like theorist of film, who also was a big influence at various stages in our lives, who used to go by John Mullarkey, has now taken on the Gaelic version, the Irish version of his name. I don't even know how to say it. Mallorca?
I'm 50-50, so I'm not going to do it out loud in a recorded setting. I think that was the first thing that got that ball rolling in my mind as well. So a mix of a film-based philosopher and a Food Network star, you know, inspired me. But I'd say, you know, if you have a name that was changed by some colonial power, you know, change it back. You have that ability. But and that's what this movie's about, right?
I taking the power back, using something along those
you
lines.
You got there, yeah.
We got there. So anyway, this week we're going to be talking about Hell or High Water, 2016 film written by Taylor Sheridan, who writes anything that has to do with the West, or really anything, it seems like nowadays, since all the TV shows that are coming out seem to have his name.
He writes every show that isn't what, like, online millennials in major cities watch. So there's
Paramount Plus is like the Sheridan, the Taylor Sheridan channel.
Yeah. So there's like the 2 to 3 million people who watch like Euphoria, Succession, Righteous Gemstones, and then the 300 million people that watch all of his shows.
That's right. That's right. And he also wrote Sicario. He wrote and directed Wind River. And what we're talking about is like Yellowstone, 1883, these TV shows that he most recently has gotten a lot of attention for. Hell or High Water was also directed by David McKenzie from Starred Up fame. I love the fact that it's a Scottish dude that's doing a very great take on the kind of American West. It stars Chris Pine and Ben Foster. And it's one of my favorite films from that year, and really one of my favorite westerns, post-westerns of the last recent memory, I would say. So as always, what we'll do is we'll go around and we'll talk about our first impressions of watching this film, what's it been like on repeated viewings, etc., etc. Let's start with Michael.
Yeah, so I missed this film the first time around because I think it did, you know, not to give myself an excuse, it went a little bit under the radar in 2016.
Hey, for a film that got nominated for 4 Academy Awards, it went way under the radar. That's what my partner and I were talking about last night. I was like, yeah, it kind of went under the radar. And she's like, it was nominated for 4 Academy Awards and a bunch of Golden Globes. And I was like, I know. For some reason, it still kind of hit.
Yeah. So I had wanted to watch it. I am a fan of the Western, the Neo-Western, the Post-Western, but truly never got around to it, which is why I was excited when producer Matt, the best podcast producer in the game, except for the Culture Binge producer Maddie, said that this was an option. I kind of jumped at it because I wanted a good excuse to watch it. I will say that I liked it very much. I've watched it 1.5 times now, once last night, and then the first half again just now. And one thing that really struck me watching it is I recently watched Peter Bogdanovich's Last Picture Show in a theater. Mm. I'd never seen the theater before. Quentin Tarantino's theater, The New Beverly, was playing it. And I thought, why not? And it's very interesting because, you know, in that movie, you have Jeff Bridges as like a 17-year-old in a small Texas town. So it's fun to watch this and just imagine it's the same guy who eventually became a Texas Ranger and fit into that role. But I like it a lot. And I would say, I'll say something kind of like controversial we can maybe unpack later. This movie is like low-key super woke for a movie that's a bunch of white guys, some of whom are explicitly racist in Texas shooting guns. It's a very woke movie, and by that I'm kind of being tongue-in-cheek, but it's a shockingly economically progressive and sort of politically critical film, and it's signposted at different points throughout, I think, in really subtle but important ways. And that's something I didn't expect. I didn't expect to watch this film and have a page of notes in front of me about, like, the relationship to the Western and the beginning and ends of capitalism and what that means. So I'm excited to maybe break that down a little bit. But yeah, only positive stuff to say. And it's a movie I think I'll definitely watch again at some point.
Awesome. What about you, Raymond?
I think I saw this one in theaters when it came out. I can't really remember because I've seen it a few times. I remember after it came out, watching it with my dad because it just has dad movies sort of written it. Yeah, written all over it.
Very good.
So it was one of those movies that I enjoyed, and you know, it was easy enough to pop in the Blu-ray player and watch with him one time when I was home. And I've seen it a couple times since then. I think it's a lot of fun. I really, really like this movie. I think it's just a solid, tight, well acted. There is some stuff with regards to the script that we can touch on later that I wanted to bring up, but not necessarily as a negative. Just I think as sort of an interesting case study. After a fashion, but I'm curious, Michael, to throw it back to you. What was the thing that made you want to rewatch the first half? Was it just like, oh, I'm just going to throw this on as a refresher real quick before jumping on the mic? Or was there something in that first half of the movie that you really wanted to chew on a little bit more?
Ooh, this is not very exciting. But the gist of it was, when I watched it last night, I kind of really got into it at about the halfway point. And by the end of the film, I was all in. It took me a little bit to get caught up. Or kind of caught into the vibe of the film. So I had a little bit of time before this, so I just threw it on to kind of pay closer attention to the first half. And I think there were like a few, you know, I don't want to say throwaway lines, but subtle things that I did miss or things I noticed around. If I would have had time, I would have loved to watch it all the way through again. But that was basically it.
All right. Yeah, I was just curious because I am interested, too, in seeing some of the stuff that you gleaned from it. And I think you brought up an interesting perspective in your first thoughts as well, that there's an economic progressivism to this. Mm-hmm. But there's also some stuff that I think Taylor Sheridan is very consciously playing with regards to some sort of subtly regressive stuff with Ben Foster's character and some not so subtly regressive stuff with Jeff Bridges' character.
Yes.
Austin, I'm curious what you think, man.
Yeah, I saw this film. I've only seen it once before, and I saw it around, you know, 2017, 2018. So it was a little bit after I saw it at home. And I loved it. And I just remembered that it was fast and action-packed and that it was this story of these brothers and that it was sort of like, I kind of have this collection in my mind of films that I called like dude poetry or masculine poetry. And it's sort of like Sam Shepard westerns are like the perfect sort of like cowboy poet stuff. And I think this fits really well into that. And then I've got stuff like The Gray, the film with Liam Neeson, which is like this really rad metaphysical exploration of the human in nature. And so I'm really interested in kind of exploring just kind of what the masculine even means and how the masculine has been portrayed throughout these various myths and stories that we tell ourselves. And so this is one of those films that just has resonated in my mind from that perspective. And I remembered that there was some sort of like post-financial crisis critique of housing and of finance, but I couldn't remember the specifics of it. Like, I couldn't remember exactly why they were robbing that bank. And then I was like, oh, that's right. And then it clicked. And then it was like, okay, it kind of made all sense that they're robbing the bank that they actually owe the back loans to. And for me, then it kind of started to ripple outwards. And then the connection to the great financial crisis made a lot of sense. And then the connection to a lot of like resentment and then the racial tensions and things like that start to make a little bit more sense. And then I started to even see this time around some of the gendered biases or the gendered prejudices, right? Where there's this just a tiny little line where, you know, Chris Pine's wife, he says something like, you know, I'm giving you all of this and then you're going to take care of it. And she's like, great, another thing for me to do. And you kind of get this idea that, you know, the women have really been betrayed by a certain type of man. So I thought there was something really interesting in that. And then, of course, you just have like a really kind of opposite of what we talked about last week. You really just have a personal redemption story. And I think each of the characters have their own redemption arc, which is really interesting. And I think the debt that is meant to be paid off in the literal sense to the bank is also mirrored, or there's a parallel to these debts that these men maybe owe to society or to God or whatever. And I think the film ends on this very sort of, you think that everything's wrapped up, but I don't think that there is peace. And I think you sort of get this idea that the cycle of violence continues. The cycle of discontent continues, which is also kind of ties into a lot of the work that I've been doing recently on this notion of like infinite debt and whether or not that infinite debt can ever be paid off, and how in the economy, the banks are the ones who continue to force us to be burdened by these debts. But in society, that there are these like religious figures, you know, you got Jeff Bridges' character who's talking about God a lot, the backdrop of Texas, you know, God is invoked quite a bit. And then there's this idea that there's these breaks of time, right? That these new epochs, right? These new sort of periods of time, and that there's these like divisions. You have the young boys, then you have like the kind of like 40-year-old men, and then you have like the retirees. And there's like these generational slippages, I guess we might say. And so the film was just, it really came alive to me last night in a way that, like, I think, well, maybe that part will stick with me more than it had previously. But I just think this is a fantastic film all across the board. I love when pretty boys just get a little bit of scruff and a hat. And then they do, like we talked about this with Chris Evans in Snowpiercer. Like, that's what they do with, like, really, really pretty boys. They give them a little bit of a beard and they put a hat on.
But
or
Pine
a
pulls
on.
It off. He pulls it off in a way Evans great. Never could. Evan is just, like, kind of too pretty at a certain level. Whereas Pine just, I buy it. And I think even with Pine, there was, yeah. I think on the press tour for this film or something after it, he showed up, like, whiskey drunk to some interview awesome. Event thing, and I'm like, yeah, like, because he's a little bit about that life. Oh, and he had his DUI in New Zealand once, whereas I just feel like Evans wouldn't pull that. Not to say it's like cool to get DUIs, but I think that Pine's interesting, you know. He has his English literature degree from Berkeley, so we know he's a thinking man, but he also is known to booze a little bit, so he's that type of guy. And I also regularly see him leaving a yoga class near my place in LA, so he's also a healthy one. He contains multitudes.
I dig that. That's my kind of role model.
Actually,
I mean,
yes.
Come on, man.
You're very much a Chris Pine type.
He looks pretty good in a cowboy hat too.
And his eyes, man, come on, those piercing eyes. And I gotta say this, because Ben Foster, I think people
one
who
of his
are,
generation's finest on-screen scumbags.
Amazing.
I think that he's one of his generation's best actors.
He's great. Yeah.
Like, I think that he is truly phenomenal, and I think that he kind of flies under the radar. Like, people don't, when they talk about the great actors that are like late 30s, early 40s, not too many people are like Ben Foster, Ben Foster, Ben Foster.
Yeah.
And I think it's because he plays a lot of supporting roles.
Have you seen Leave No Trace?
Yes.
I was going to say, that seems like a very Austin Ben Foster movie. But sorry for cutting you off.
No, that's basically yeah. it. I just truly think that he is remarkable.
Yeah,
and
he plays chaos in such a really perfectly. Electric and scary way. And throughout the film, he manages to sort of like create a tension that would normally exist maybe between two characters or like between a character and a setting all internally. So it's like when he walks into a room or a scene, or even the scene where, you know, I don't know if I'm getting ahead of it, but like, you know, the scene where he's at the gas station and just stares at a guy that rolls up in a car playing like rap rock. And his simple stare injects a violent chaos into a situation.
There's a movie that came out like 5 years ago called Hostiles. It's directed by Scott Cooper. And I was sitting in the theater watching it. It's not a bad movie. But about halfway through it, I'm sitting there thinking to myself, like, you know what this movie really needs is just like a good old dose of Ben Foster, and then not 10 minutes later he comes in
amazing
and just starts stampeding through the fucking scene. It's great. But there is definitely a certain type of Ben Foster movie at this point. I think he does, maybe one of the reasons he flies under the radar is he does get typecast a little bit, but I think he's wonderful.
Yeah. So, okay. So before we start kind of peeling back the layers and turn the mic over to Mike a little bit here so we can get into some of the meatier stuff, let's do a quick plot rundown. So basically the story starts off in West Texas where brothers Toby and Tanner, they robbed a couple branches of Texas Midland Bank. Though the robberies are well planned, Tanner's wild nature, that's Ben Foster, leads him to take unnecessary risks, frustrating Toby. Now back at their family ranch, they bury the getaway car in a pit with a backhoe. Their mother has recently died after a long illness, leaving the ranch in debt because of a reverse mortgage provided by Texas Midlands Bank, which would lead to its foreclosure if not settled immediately. Meanwhile, oil has actually been recently discovered on their land, and Toby's determined to ensure a comfortable life for his estranged sons. Now, there's two Texas Rangers, Marcus and Alberto, and they're assigned to the case. So Marcus is pretty close to retirement, just a couple weeks away. He investigates robbery, and he quickly determines that the brothers are in on this, and he decides to set up a sort of sting operation where they're going to stake out the what he believes to be the final Texas Midland bank that they're going to hit up, and they'll be able to catch him in the act. But because the brothers have a pretty good plan, they have figured out a way to convert money through a casino, which makes their money untraceable and kind of leaves them in the clear. Now, the two Rangers, when they're staking out the Texas Midland Bank, they end up finding nothing, but they figure out that there's a pattern to these bank robberies, and they determine that it's either this bank or the one in Post. So they decide to go to Post, which is in Oklahoma, right? Because this is all taking place in either Texas or Oklahoma. So Post is in Oklahoma, is that right?
I think it's in Texas as well. I think the casino is in Oklahoma, where they go to money laundering, yeah. And then they go back
to
Texas.
Okay, cool, yeah. Okay, great. So they figure out that that's going to be the final one. So they head on the road to kind of go head them off. But what happens is that the brothers arrive at the bank early in the morning, obviously before the Rangers get there, but not early enough to beat the crowd. And so there's a boatload of people in the crowd. They jump in there and a shootout ensues because it's freaking Texas and people have guns everywhere. Toby gets shot, and Toby drives off as they're being chased by a posse of townspeople. The brothers then race out of town with the local posse in pursuit, and after gaining some distance, Tanner stops and fires an automatic weapon at him, scaring everybody off. The brothers then split up. Toby takes the money using another vehicle while Tanner creates a diversion. He draws all the lawmen into the desert, hides up in the hills, and starts picking them off with a sniper rifle, and ends up fatally shooting Alberto. Now, Toby passes through a police checkpoint without any incident, and he launders the stolen cash at a casino where he sees the news reports that his brother has actually been killed himself. He takes the casino's check to the bank just in time to avoid the ranch's foreclosure, and he actually turns the ranch over into a family trust. Again, Texas Midland Bank. Now, following his retirement, Hamilton visits his former office. This is Marcus. This is Jeff Bridges' character. He visits the former office after his retirement, and he learns that Toby's been cleared as a suspect, as his record is clean and he has no motive, since his new oil wells earn him more in a month than the total stolen of it all and the robberies altogether. The money from the ranch's oil wells is deposited at the Texas Midlands Bank, which refuses to cooperate with the investigation for fear of losing management of the family's trust fund. Now, despite the lack of evidence, Marcus remains certain that Toby was involved, but the person who took over is like, hey, it's a dead issue, go enjoy your retirement. But Marcus doesn't like this, so he confronts Toby at the ranch and he wishes to know the reason behind the robberies. Toby basically explains that he's resolved to not let poverty affect his sons like it had affected him and Tanner. Marcus tells Toby that he holds him responsible for the death of Alberto, and the tension of their conversation builds as a clear prelude to an impending violent shootout. But they're interrupted when Toby's ex-wife and children arrive. As Marcus departs, Toby suggests that they meet again soon to finish the conversation and bring some peace. Marcus replies that he would like to meet again, and maybe he will bring some peace to Toby before leaving. And that's the end of the movie. All right, before we continue, though, we got to give a shout-out to our sponsor of this week's episode, Storyblocks. Look, Storyblocks is freaking rad, okay? They are the complete stock solution that provides an unlimited library of over a million-plus royalty-free, high-quality audio, video, and images, all through cost-effective subscription plans. I've used Storyblocks for years, Wisecrack on the main channel. We use Storyblocks, and they're great because you basically have a royalty-free, demand-driven library that's right at your fingertips with an ever-growing library of content that is basically being optimized. So they're adding like new 4K and HD footage, for example, After Effects and Premiere Pro templates, music, images, special effects, and more. And remember, all the assets are royalty-free, so you can use them for both commercial and personal projects. And one of the cool things that they've been doing more recently is really beefing out their diversity and inclusivity with regards to content. So they're always changing the face of stock footage to help creators tell the stories in unique and authentic ways that are better representative of a diverse and cosmopolitan culture. And so it's called Restock, and that's their commitment to increasing representation in stock media. And they hire creators from marginalized communities to actually produce this content. So it's really a great initiative. And like I said, I have used Storyblocks forever, and Wisecrack use it, and I've really never been let down. So you got to have a Storyblocks account. So head over to storyblocks.com/wisecrack, and you can learn all about what they've got to offer. So that's storyblocks.com/wisecrack. Or you can click the link down below. So, all right. Let's get back to the show.
Can I say one thing before we get into it?
Yes, yes.
Great. Thank you for that. If anyone listening is planning to do a bank robbery, I would just say go to the most liberal neighborhood of a liberal state, right? You want to rob a bank where people aren't going to have guns in lines and where the customers aren't going to feel the need to be vigilantes and chase you down in service of capital. You want customers who are going to think to themselves as they're face down on the floor, you know what, man? Fuck the bank. Take that money, dude. As they are on their way to a reading group or a juice bar or something. I would just say, you know, this movie shows you where and where not to rob banks. And I know that we have a large criminal contingent to listen to this podcast.
That's so right, folks. You want to rob banks that are populated by docile liberal sheeple, just like Michael Burns. Exactly. Just like liberal sickos over at Wisecrack.
I would be on the ground like, cool, man. Like, good luck. Fuck this. Fuck Chase
Manhattan. This money's all insured anyway, so it's not going to actually hurt them. So fuck it. It doesn't matter.
I just got so anxious in the movie at a certain point. I was like, God damn it. We're in Texas. Everyone has guns. And when the guys were chasing them, I was like, who does that? If I saw someone commit a robbery to a bank, I wouldn't be like, I got to go stick up for that motherfucking bank.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's worth pointing out, too. So I read a little interview with Tyler Sheridan where he's talking about the film when he was doing like
Taylor Sheridan,
when he's doing the when he's doing a press tour at the early release of the film, and he was kind of talking about how he, you know, he's from this area and he wanted to give a sort of richer representation of the culture and of the people, especially in the light of the Trump election, which really kind of caricatured, and there was a lot of debates about like what led to the election of Trump. Was it just dumb redneck idiots who didn't know anything, or was it white working class resentments in these quote unquote flyover states, you know? And so Sheridan, he wanted to say, look, I actually want to give a sort of more like rich understanding of certain economic problems that kind of can explain some of the patterns, why people feel like their worlds are being stripped away from them, and why the towns, like there's so much imagery of these ghost towns and these deserted towns, and of payday loan billboards that are just fucking predatory, that are like feeding off of these people who are desperate. And so it can really kind of create a much richer socioeconomic context for understanding some of the tensions, some of the kind of social tensions that are arising there. But well, so Michael, that, you didn't yeah go ahead.
I was going to say, thinking of this, it just makes you think of that graffiti we see about 30 seconds into the film on the wall outside the bank that says three tours in Iraq but no bailout for people like us. And it's just interesting because you could see that being a quote that you could see people on the far right and the far left both seeing something like that and being like, fuck yeah. But sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. I was just thinking about that in the context of the scene you were setting.
No, but it's one of those things that, like, Taylor Sheridan is a fairly conservative guy, but I think he hits on something with this that is, like, if we're all sort of honest with ourselves, I think that, like, the last time that 99% of Americans could agree on something was, like, that the housing collapse fucked over everybody, and then the government fucked over everybody again by bailing out banks. And it is that, like, that moment that this film kind of captures, where it's like, oh yeah, these folks are essentially portrayed as, or, you know, I'm sure we'll get into this a little bit, Austin, since we've been pulling at the mythology thread with regards to all of our Western films, is that these guys, I think, one, Ben Foster really sees himself as something of a folk hero in a way. Whereas Chris Pine, I think, is a guy who's in a tough situation, who's going with, you know, the last idea that they had in order to get themselves out of this jackpot. But it's kind of an interesting film in how it's able to sort of align those perspectives and focus it on these sort of like utilitarian ends of just we gotta get X. I mean, that's the thing that even tips Jeff Bridges off, is like they're trying to raise a certain amount of money. And I think that's sort of key to not only the charm of the characters, but key to getting you on their side, is that this isn't just some fly by night operation where they're just a little light and they want to make things better for themselves or whatever. They are rectifying a grave injustice. And while Ben Foster is in sort of like the vocabulary of cinema, probably as close to this movie has as a traditional antagonist, he's really just more like the guy who's handling this in the wrong way, whereas the big bad is, of course, Texas Midlands Bank. It gives you something to root for. It puts you in their corner a little bit.
Yeah, there is something interesting also with Ben Foster's character that Marcus hits on at the end that I think is interesting. He says that, you know, he calls him his dim-witted brother when he's talking to Pine, and he's like, you know, he didn't plan it. He did it because it was fun. And that's why, at the end, he kind of sacrifices himself. I mean, does he think he's going to get away? I mean, you know, he sits up there on the hilltop after he's sniped Lord of the Plains. Yeah, and there's something about him wanting to be, like, to embody a certain mythology, a certain notion of what it means to be an outlaw. And so he's trying really hard to do it. And so he enjoys, that's why he goes off on that one and he robs that one bank by himself. Like, just does it, that wasn't just part of the plan. The
so yeah. Casually, he says he has just to take a shit and he's just like, hey, brother, pay the bill, meet me outside.
Running towards
yeah.
The
fuck, yeah. Like, for him, there was something about the thrill of just kind of, fuck, I don't know if he had the principles so much. Like, first of all, he doesn't really care about his mother so much. So that's not one of the principles that's driving him.
And he shot
second,
his dad,
he doesn't
right?
really, yeah, a hunting accident,
yeah,
hunting, hunting in a barn. They say, yeah, yeah, he shot and killed his dad. So he kind of is a man without an ethic. He's kind of like a Joker character, you know, from The Dark Knight. You know, he kind of lives in that space of chaos, of indecidability. And it's funny, my girl turned to me like, 5 minutes in, 10 minutes in, and she's like, oh, he's the loose cannon that's gonna fuck everything up. And I was like, yeah. Like, she just was like, okay, I see where this is going. Whereas Pine, he has an ethos. Like, for him, he has demons that are haunting him because he did not treat his family the way that he could have, maybe that he would have wanted to, and he couldn't break the cycle of poverty that he was thrown into. And so for him, this is an opportunity to sort of find peace, right? But like every great Western that deals with the man of violence, you can never actually enjoy the benefits of the spoils, right? It's John Wayne not being able to go into the house at the end of Searchers. It's Logan dying. It's Shane dying, right? It's that constant idea that you can never actually come back into quote-unquote civilized society if you've made peace through the means of violence. And so there's some really interesting polarities and some interesting kind of motifs that are explored between those two.
I agree with you, Austin, but I also I want to push back on the notion that Ben Foster is just kind of chaos, that, you know, as the Joker, you know, the character you've compared him to, as he's referred to in the movie, that like, oh, some people just want to watch the world burn or what have you. I don't really feel that with Ben Foster. I actually think in some ways his ideology or his sort of like animating philosophy is maybe a little bit more pernicious. Not necessarily that I find him as a character to be unsympathetic, but this is something I kind of alluded to in what I said earlier about the movie having sort of like a subtle or sly regressive aspect to that character is that Jeff Bridges' partner in this, when they're sitting outside the one bank, he tells them, you know, like, because he's Native American, he says, well, my people used to own this land, and now, and then your people took this land, and now they took it from you. And there is this sort of like knock-on effect of trauma that the movie is sort of examining. And there's this scene at the casino where Ben Foster is talking to a Native American, and he goes, you know, Comanche means enemy. And he goes, all right, well, you know what that makes me. And the guy says, what does he say to him?
An enemy? My enemy.
Yeah. And he goes, yeah. No, it makes me a Comanche. And
that scene is so intense.
Yeah. It's a great piece of writing. But I think one of the things it sort of betrays is this notion that, like, Ben Foster, while certainly a victim of, you know, predatory lending, reverse mortgage, housing collapse, all of the above, you know, big banking in general, he sees that not as something that animates him within this one specific context. He now sees himself, a white guy, as being kicked down the rung of privilege on a societal scale. And in the way that he responds to that character in the casino, it's one of those things where, like, you get the notion that he loves the idea of being this underdog or this marginalized person, or, like, to him, the idea of, like, Native American suffering and identity, it's, I mean, he's quite literally appropriating it in this context, that to him it's just like, oh no, this is something that I can just sort of grasp onto and sort of play act because it feeds into my sense of self mythology. And it is a sly piece of writing. I think it's very effective in that regard.
Yeah. Doesn't he say something, just to riff off the self mythology thing, when they're in the gas station, he's waiting for his Winstons and Dr. Pepper, and the rap rock guys in the green car roll up, and then Chris Pine takes him out just very deftly. But then he says something like, I think Chris Pine is like, you could have got yourself killed, blah, blah, blah. And he was like, no, I'm not supposed to die like that. Or there's some sense of mythologizing, yeah, where like, no, that's not how I'm going to go. This confidence that he knows he's going to go in some glorious fashion, which, you know, turns out to half and half be true. But yeah.
It reminds me of Dignan in Bottle Rocket, where he goes, you know, they'll never catch me because I'm fucking innocent. And and there is that streak with Ben Foster that, you know, maybe by the time we do Power of the Dog next week, we will have beaten the self-mythology horse to death. But there is that strain in this movie where, like, you know, like I always say, the best villains are the heroes of their own story. He absolutely sees himself as the hero of this narrative, of the movie in his head. And that, I think, Michael, that's a perfect illustration of that scene.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends, so for me, it's, you know,
trying, like, to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
The only thing I don't know, I agree that he's definitely, he's self-mythologizing, you know? But what I don't know is, I don't know if he has internalized the victim narrative so much as he has never had a narrative. And it isn't like Chris Pine, who he clearly has a set of, like, circumstances that he's warring against, right? But Ben Foster's been a lifetime criminal. He's served for robberies before, a lot of time, too. Like, so he's kind of always been an agent of chaos, a nomad, an outlaw, for lack of better terms, right? And so what I wonder is I wonder if, because like the Michael Caine line, when Alfred says, you know, some men just want to watch the world burn, Mike, he's wrong. Like, that's the whole point, is that Batman can't understand. No one can understand. Like, Michael Caine isn't right. Michael Caine is a mouthpiece for a certain type of person that can't understand what the Joker's doing, right? Which is why when Batman comes up to him in the prison and he's like, what do you want me to die for? And he's like, I don't want you to die. He's like, I fucking love you, man. Because the Joker has a set of principles. It's just not one that is understood by the status quo. And so I think it's kind of something similar with Foster here. I don't think that his principles are, I'm the marginalized because of the financial collapse. Because when Chris Pine says, why did you come along with me? He doesn't give him anything except for, because you asked me to. And that's it.
Yeah,
that's
it. Was like, you're it. My little brother. And you asked.
And you asked. Yeah. So for me, it's a very different, like, I just don't know if he has internalized. Now, maybe it's unconscious. And I'm sure there's like some sort of structural unconscious, like formation of the psyche that would make it so that he's like, feeling the symptoms of those collapses. But I think that he kind of just is, I think he's just getting his rocks off, you know, in a way. He's kind of just fucking everything, for lack of it, like, you know, like in the metaphorical sense, like everything is libidinal for him. He has so much fun. That's why he's hooping and hollering and he's like, you know.
No, I
like,
think you're onto something with that libidinous drive there. And I do think it's like interesting when we find out at the end of the film, and this is kind of indicated throughout, but when the Texas Ranger who takes over for Jeff Bridges is talking about the brother, Chris Pine, and she's like, he has a clean record. Like, he's never been arrested, never done anything. And it kind of sets up this contrast where they both seem like down and out failures, but it's like Chris Pine's character failed within the system, or unless he was doing a bunch of crimes he just magically got away with, whereas it seemed like the Ben Foster character tapped out of any attempt to play within the boundaries of a system a long time ago, and isn't letting sort of like a systemic ethos or set of boundaries sort of make him repress that desire or that libidinal energy.
And that also kind of feeding into Austin's theory that he is not abiding by the rules of an internal narrative or anything, that notion that like, oh, maybe the reason that he's willing to go die in a blaze of glory is not just because of his own perceived self-mythology, but also because there is really like no happy ending for him, that, you know, he just can't stay away from the heat, he can't stay away from the action.
Well, you know, there's something a little Kenny Powers about it in a really dark way. For anyone who doesn't know that reference, I'm referring to the show Eastbound and Down.
Katie Mixon is in the,
yes,
in this one.
Maybe that's Eastbound what I was thinking about it. But yeah, like in that, like, he just wants to like do rad shit, where Kenny Powers just wants to like, yeah, do some coke and jet ski with a naked woman on the back of it. Ben Foster, in a much more kind of insidious way, is like, you know, it'd be fun fucking shooting a gun on top of a ridge at cops, SWAT teams, guys. Like, it's just he's having so much fun in a way that does seem like, not to get too preciously psychoanalytic about it, but like, he's there's an energy, and it's a similar energy we see when he meets a nice young lady and fucks her in the hotel room next to his brother, which is weird too. I would just say, if you're gonna rob a bank, don't do it in Texas. Don't have sex in front of your brother as well would be another rule
that Michael's I would like rule to number to two. All. Yeah.
Rule number two. Put that in the show notes. Just the
10
rules.
Simple rules by Michael Burns.
But yeah, he is having a blast at the casino. Like, he when Chris Pine is taking the chips just to hold them and then launder them back and get and cash out. Ben Foster creeps into the frame and he starts pulling chips out because he wants to go play poker and stuff. And
yeah, because he's capable of that. Like,
have you fucking forgotten what we're doing?
Yeah. Chris Pine is in like fucking mission mode. This guy is like up at night, unable to sleep, planning. He, you know, not sure if they're going to make this. And Ben Foster's like, fuck it, man. I got some sick guns. Met a girl at the front desk. Going to gamble a little bit. Stare a Comanche in the eye like I don't have any fear in my heart.
It's one of those things. What's that? That quote of like, everyone has a plan until you get hit in the face. And it is one of those things. You kind of get the sense with him that's like, yeah, I get it, all your logic and your theory, and we may plan these bank heists down to the nth degree, But when push comes to shove, or when the rubber hits the road, or when you get hit in the face, you just kind of have to go with it. So why not just go with it from the beginning? why not just lean into that?
Yeah. I have a question for you all, if I might pose it about this. This is probably my one entry in your Western series. I can't time travel back to last week. I don't think I'm doing it next week. So I wanted to ask a larger question about Westerns this film made me think of, right? And you can correct me if my history on this is wrong. But a lot of the classic Westerns leading up to the end of the West stuff, we're talking about an era that's like pre-capitalist. Like, they're not doing capitalism in the traditional West. They're sort of settling, founding businesses, inventing law and ways of order. And I was thinking about a film, and I might be getting this plot wrong. Austin will know, because if anyone cares about this, some fun background info. Most of the foundational Westerns I ever watched were in an apartment with Austin and our friend John from Worcester, Mass, watching the films of Sam Peckinpah.
Shout out
to John, yeah. And is it the Ballad of Cable Hogue where he finds water? Yeah, but then at the end, no one's stopping for water anymore because gas has emerged and people are driving on by. Great.
That's right.
So when I think about that movie, it's almost like
it's one of my favorites.
Yeah, it's a brilliant movie. And a great example of Sam Peckinpah having a great sense of humor, where normally he just wants to make you watch people die. but in that film, it's sort of like his Western story ends as industrialization, capitalism, automobiles, oil start rising. So it's almost like you can't have a Western in that context. And part of me thinks with this movie, what it had me thinking was like, if you take that Western framework and then you plop it in this moment, at a moment we could call the decline of capitalism, it's like the Western ends up being accidentally anti-capitalist. Because again, Taylor Sheridan is not out here with Mao's little red book in his pocket as final draft open. I don't think that's what he's trying to do, but it kind of feels like classic Westerns were pre-capitalist, and now we're seeing what happens when you put the same type of sort of motivation, story, plot stuff in the decline of capitalism, especially in those sort of Texas towns where the system isn't really working. To me, it kind of seems like we're getting this new, I guess, like if the end of the West was initially the beginning of the financialization of the country, now with like the failure of that, with the mortgage system collapsing, all this sort of stuff, it almost provides this really nice return for those Western narratives. And if that just was nonsense, you all can tell me and we can delete this. But
No, I get what you're saying. I think that I wonder how much of it is conscious or not. I mean, like you just kind of laid out perfectly there, Michael. I think the history of the Western is like almost by necessity about the encroachment of capitalism at times. Like, there are a lot of examples, you know, like Once Upon a Time in the West, another phenomenal Jason Robards movie, has a similar plot to it, where there's a homesteader who has discovered water in the middle of a vast expanse, and is devising to build an entire town based around that discovery. I think that there's this sort of... I wonder how much of it, though, is ideological versus aesthetic. What I'm trying to say is that, like, during the sort of like fall of American empire, as I think well illustrated in this film, as you know, the financial collapse being one of the major precipitating events to where we are today, there is this sense of like, well, as things just kind of hollow out and ghost towns pop up in a modern context, it's just one of those things of like, well, how else can you frame a story within that context? That there is just sort of a, and I'm not saying this to rebuke anything you were saying. I'm curious what you
rebuke
guys think.
Away.
No. I'm curious what you guys think. Do you think it is an ideological thing consciously, or is it just like,
no,
well,
I don't think it's conscious at all.
There's sort of, yeah, this sort of like civilizational retraction that just leads to it lends itself to a natural aesthetic idiom.
Yeah. I mean, that would be my thought, that it's not conscious, but that it still emerges because of the mixture of that type of storytelling and that type of socioeconomic background. I don't think it's consciously doing that, but I think it ends up sort of unconsciously emerging or something like that. Austin, what do you think about my nonsense?
Well, I think it's interesting. I would say that if you look at a lot of the classic Westerns, a lot of them have to do with, like Raymond was just talking about, the discovery of a resource, which would then turn into the privatization of a resource, which then it would turn into the construction of a town, which would then turn into like the production of this larger industrial setting that would feed into highways that would connect with cities. So there's clearly some sort of capitalist industry in its like burgeoning, maybe we would call it primitive accumulation phases. But there's also like you get this in a lot of them where it's like, you know, cattle barons come in and they start fencing off the land, and then the ranchers are like, what the fuck, you can't fence off the land, like the land is common. So there's the enclosure of the commons, which is generally seen as one of the narratival structures of the foundations of capitalism dating back to 17th century England, right? So I've developed, like in my own work, which forthcoming in hopefully in a book here in the next year or so, where I call like I'm looking at like what is like the essential logic of capitalism and the essential logic of finance in particular. And I think there's at least one way we can look at it, that it operates by like a threefold structure and what I call inscription, enclosure, and quantification. And so inscription is the act of like meaning making, right? So let's take Once Upon a Time in the West and the discovery of water. So the discovery of the water isn't the meaning making activity under capitalism. It's when that meaning making activity turns the resource into a resource for a particular purpose, right? It is water for a town. That's the first kind of moment, right? It as an instance, right? With land, it would be, this is land that will be used for cattle farming or for cattle grazing, right? Then there's the second step, which is enclosure. And enclosure is the act of incorporation or privatization. And that's where you say, oh, we own this resource, or this land is now the property of X group or corporation or something like that. And then the third step is quantification. And then that's when you basically can figure out how to turn this otherwise qualitative thing, you know, water is good for survival, into something that's water is worth X amount of dollars, right? So this threefold, kind of this tripartite scheme is, I think, is a really good way to kind of understand it. And when we think about it in those terms, then we can look at a film like Logan even, and we can say, actually, Logan is still about inscription of DNA, enclosure, privatization of it by that corporation, and quantification. The privatization of that resource is now going to lead toward massive super profits for a particular corporation that's trying to colonize DNA. And that's what's being discussed in Logan, is it isn't the enclosure of land, it's the enclosure of another resource, which is information in the form of DNA, right? And so I think that all Westerns actually deal with this. And you get the same thing in Hell or High Water, but now it's the financialization of property, of town, or what sometimes is even referred to in the literature, what's called like the anthropology of finance, what's called like the financialization of everyday life, right? Which is that every aspect of your life, where you live, how you live, where are you going to go eat, how are you going to eat, what are the relationships that we exchange with each other? Are they going to be debt relationships? You know, is it going to be like, I give to you, therefore you owe me back plus interest? I mean, whatever. These sorts of frames of thinking can be related to this tendency at the economic level of financialization, but it translates into kind of like much deeper social aspects. And I think in that sense, this film is actually not post-capitalist in any way, but it's actually thoroughly capitalist in the sense that it's maybe even like the most potent form of capitalism, the most kind of like radical and extreme and efficient form of capitalism that has presented itself. And this film is like, ah, and here are the tensions. And then, if I can just loop this around, the last thing I'll say, what this ties into then is the construction of the outlaw. The outlaw in the form of a bank robber has always existed, which is the person living outside against that tripartite model of inscription, enclosure, and quantification, and they're trying to do something different, right? In the case of like John Wayne or Shane, where they're fighting against the robber barons, or I'm sorry, the cattle barons or something like that, right? It's them kind of trying to kind of wrest aside the local, like take the local back from the evil big corporation, right? And then in this one, you kind of get something similar. You get them coming up with a clever scheme whereby the bank that is extracting hyper profits actually becomes the ones that service their own debt, right? And so it's the same kind of thing. It's just got these different kind of nuances to it. And I think there's a real consistency here from the old classical westerns all the way up through kind of like the neo and post-westerns.
The outlaw being a side effect of enclosure, essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. But before we continue, you know the deal. We got to give a shout out to our sponsor, Skillshare. Look, Skillshare is a rad sponsor. They've been with us for ages. And the cool thing about them is it's an online learning community where you can get access to classes and then connect with other like-minded creators. And you can basically learn about any skill that you would want to if you are a young or intermediate or even advanced creator looking to sharpen some skills. So one of the things that I've recently been doing is I've been looking through their library on all their rad classes that they have in digital design and inclusive design, and they've just got so much stuff that it's really helped me kind of build out my own skill set with a lot of my production work. So you can go ahead and check that out, as well as all kinds of other skills. If you're a filmmaker, if you're a photographer, if you are a writer, they have all kinds of classes that you can access if you head over to Skillshare. And of course, if you are a listener of Show Me the Meaning, then you can get actually a free trial of their premium membership at Skillshare.com/SMTM. That's Skillshare.com/SMTM, or you can click the link down below in the show notes. So make sure to go to Skillshare.com/SMTM so you can explore your creativity and pursue your passions right from the comforts of your very own home by learning about all the goodness that you want to enhance your skills. Skillshare.com/SMTM, or click the link below. All right, back to the show.
This is something that I kind of alluded to in my opening thoughts, and you bringing up the bank and kind of landing on that note. I wanted to touch on something with regards to the script in this film. And it's going to sound like a criticism, but it really isn't. I mentioned the stagecoach rule on the last episode or two, Austin. The John Ford movie, the notion of, you know, why don't the Native Americans shoot at the horses instead of at the stagecoach? Well, because then there'd be no movie.
Right.
So there is, the stagecoach rule is very much in effect in Hell or High Water, because these guys could go to literally any bank in Texas, any other non-Texas Midlands bank, explain the situation to them, say, like, we need to pay off this mortgage and a bunch of, like, back payments or whatever, and we'll be able to make you whole 10 times over with just a month of pumping out the oil that's speculators have told us is underneath our land. They could just explain this to literally any bank in the state, or I dare say in the country.
But we're assuming they would know to do that and think to do that?
I'm not saying that they would know to do that, yeah, or that they would think to do that. Like I said, this is going to sound like a criticism.
Yeah.
But I think even if they do think to do that, and once again, then there'd be no movie. It certainly wouldn't be as exciting as this movie is, just them signing a bunch of paperwork with a different bank to trade over the lease. But one of the things that I wanted to touch on with this is that I think it stands in stark contrast to something like Little Miss Sunshine, which we recently discussed, where the entire narrative of that film is built on a similarly very shaky sort of premise. But I think the reason it works in this film as opposed to Little Miss Sunshine is that notion of, like, cinematic or ecstatic truth that, like, we've talked a lot about the sort of visual vocabulary of a Western, the sort of idiom within which these characters not only are painted, but in which they perceive themselves. There is this notion, when I watch it at least, that Michael, they very well may have thought of that, but either Ben Foster talked Chris Pine out of it, or Ben Foster thought of it and never told Chris Pine because he still wants to get his rocks off. So it's just one of those things I kind of wanted to throw your way, gentlemen, and just kind of see what you think about that, when not necessarily just in this movie, but when you watch a movie that is built on a really shaky premise that could be resolved very easily without any conflict, drama, or death, What is the thing that makes you go along with the movie, or what's the thing that kind of takes you out of it?
Yeah. Michael, what'd you think?
Well, I mean, just narrative-wise, maybe it's because I have dumb baby brain, but I just loved how neatly it wrapped up, where they took the money from the bank to pay off the mortgage to that bank to set up a trust with that bank to then include that bank on the oil money so that also that bank would have no reason to further inquire upon Chris Pine's complicity, which I did think that was the most interesting thing. Not the most interesting thing, but I like that last conversation that Jeff Bridges has with his replacement, where she basically is like, the bank doesn't care. They stole $40,000 from the bank. They're making that off these guys every week now, or whatever it is. And I enjoyed that so much that it doesn't bother me, but I do. I definitely get what you're saying there, Raymond.
No, I'm not saying it bothers me.
The script is bad and that you would physically fight Taylor Sheridan in any field.
The reason I bring it up is to reiterate, I think there are times at which you can just claim the stagecoach rule and just say, well, there'd be no movie. And I think this is the kind of movie that's worth it to sort of fudge the numbers around the margins a little bit and buy into this premise that otherwise could be very easily resolved.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the reason that it's successful and that it works is because of the kind of polarities that you get that are always just appealing to people. Like, so if you have like the kind of straight man and the wild man, like that's just something that automatically, and that's set up from the very beginning as soon as that opening bank robbery scene happens. And I think that's the other thing too, is my partner, she looked at me and she was kind of like, oh, like, is this going to be like a fucking violent shoot him in the head? She's like, are they going to kill that woman? Like, and that's not her favorite style of movie. So for her, it was kind of a, and then about halfway, three quarters through, she was like, I fucking love this movie. She got so into it. So there was something about even just these relationship dramas that deepen and deepen and deepen, because it isn't until halfway through that you actually understand why they're doing what they're doing, right? You kind of just, okay, they're doing something. Are they just bad guys? Are they just like tweakers, as Alberto keeps saying? You know, you're like, what the fuck is their deal? And then you're like, nah, Chris Pine, he's got his shit together too much. He's not just doing it for chaotic reasons. There's a reason here, right? And then you're like, oh, it's curious that they're only going Texas Midlands. And then you're like, oh, wait, is it because the cameras are out? So they use a lot of like little kind of fabrications of drama to keep you invested, I think. Just like little things here. You're like, oh, so they're doing the Texas Midlands ones because the cameras are being switched out. So they just must know this because maybe one of them works at Texas Midlands Bank or they have some sort of in there somehow, right? And so you're thinking, so there's just these like little ways to lead you, maybe. I mean, I know that that's kind of like a really kind of superficial answer for it, I think, but I think that's one of the reasons why they're able to get away with it and why it works. Why you don't have a moment where you stop and you say, I could get off here if they just did this, right? It's only in reflection later that you say it, because I think the flow is so good that it just kind of keeps you giving you what you want before you even know that you want it, sort of thing.
For me, it always just comes down to that like emotional honesty, that I think these characters could come off as very archetypal, and it's a credit not only to, I think, a very good script, but also wonderful performances. I would say all around, it's a wonderful ensemble. But this is something that you touched on a little bit with our discussion of the writer, Austin, sort of with regards to blending the line between narrative and documentary, fact fiction. And you went on this big rant about how there is no objective truth within narrative. And, you know, I understood what you were saying with that and where you were going with that. And I think it's Werner Herzog who talks about this notion of ecstatic truth, that, you know, obviously everything is, to paraphrase what you were saying last week, it's a matter of, you know, where the camera's being placed, whose perspective the story is from, you know, why do they cut here as opposed to there, etc. And I do think there is something to be said about a movie like this where you really feel for these guys, and there is this beautiful, ecstatic, cinematic truth that takes you along on this journey without, like you said, having to stop at any point and be like, but this doesn't make any sense. Well, because this is what they need to do to have the movie be interesting.
Yeah, and remember how I said at the beginning, I was like, I like collect these, like, you know, what you call, for lack of a better word, like masculine poetry or like dude poetry things. The reason also, like for me, somebody like a film like Badlands or Days of Heaven kind of fits that with Terrence Malick. He was doing a sort of like cowboy poetry with those films. This film, I feel like the cinematography also lends itself to this sort of longing, right? And maybe this is partly because of the authenticity of the characters and the performances that are turned in, the relationships that are built, the fact that we really start to become invested in the circumstances that are driving them. But also there's this backdrop of destitution and desert towns. And it made me feel like there's a town here in Australia. I won't name it because I don't want to like talk shit about it because I'll probably go back there at some point soon. But we were driving through it on a recent road trip and my partner was like, oh my God, I feel like we're in the middle of like nowhere America. And I was like, yeah, I feel like this is like a town in like Oklahoma or something that has been deserted. Huge, just huge wide streets, you know, and like no cars and like storefronts that were built in like the 40s and like most of them are closed down now. And I get this, I don't know, it stirs something in me that is at once nostalgic for a time past and then also heartbroken and tragic for the fact that that time that maybe was once thriving or that was at once that they believed that they were on a path towards progress or towards prosperity, or towards happiness or peace or whatever, and that it's no longer there for them, that age has been subsumed under something else. And so there's this tragedy and this hopefulness that's kind of all complicating each other. And then there are just some shots. Like there's a shot where it's a landscape. Well, no, it's like a wide shot where you've got Ben Foster leaning up against a pole, drinking a beer, and you got Chris Pine just a little off center frame, sitting on the bed of his truck, and they're talking, and then the ranch is in the background, and there's a little bit of barbed wire in the foreground, and then you've just got this land, this like expanse in the background, and I'm like, that's every frame a painting. That is a painting. And I was like, that is so beautiful. And it just gives you everything you need to know about who they are. Foster, the way he's leaning, drinking his beer. Pine, sitting there pensive in the center of the screen. The ranch in the background. This beautiful backdrop of Texas. It just gives you everything you need to know in one visual image. And I think that's really great storytelling. And when you have those things, it gets you. And if you're not paying attention to it, it still lands on you unconsciously. And if you are paying attention to it, then it gives you like this real rational meat to really chew on. And I think this film does that very well.
Oh, that was really well put.
Yeah, I would agree, and I think everything. No, all I was going to say is that everything you were saying about what that drive through Australia sort of evoked in you, Austin, I think ties quite neatly into what Michael was saying about the sort of retraction of civilization against which this film is set.
Yeah. And it's too bad we don't have too much time. We got to kind of wrap it up here. But I'd love to also just at least put this out there for people to think about how that speech that Alberto gives about how, you know, this land was all once my ancestors until your people came along and stole it. And then now those people came along and stole it. One of my favorite kinds of Westerns is the kind of the person who doesn't belong anymore. Like the times are passing you by sort of thing. Like the Ballad of Cable Hogue, right? Unforgiven is kind of one of those, you know? A man who has to get brought back, right? And so I find that really interesting. Just as somebody who's getting older and you start thinking about like what you're going to leave behind, are you going to leave anything behind? Does that matter? Is that just like hubris? Is that something that shouldn't matter? And then you start thinking about what you've inherited from people before you. And then you start thinking about how we modify that which we've inherited and how we've changed it, sometimes virtuously and very often in violent and horrific ways. And so for me, there's something just really interesting about like this generational divides or the movement, the slippage of time or something like that, that this film addresses, that I think is so interesting, because now what's the mover of time? The mover of time is the movement and power of finance and who controls finance. And then what you see is how that exerts its power over the everyday person, you know? And to me, I think that's just a really lovely kind of motif that the film kind of hits on. So, but last thoughts, we can't get too much into that. Let's just do final thoughts here. We got a couple more minutes. So Michael, anything else we didn't discuss that you wanted to kind of just kind of provoke us with?
Ooh, not really. I think we covered a lot of good stuff, and I don't want to add too much more to the thought feast that hath been served out. But more than anything, I think a great film, a great evidence for why the Western still works and maybe works better than ever.
Yeah.
And definitely something, if you are like me and just kind of let this film pass you by when it came out, highly recommended on Netflix right now. What else are you going to do for an hour and 47 minutes?
That's it. What about you, Raymond?
Well, I'll tell them exactly what to do with their hour and 47 minutes. If you've already seen Hell or High Water and you want to see some of these themes tackled from exclusively a Native American perspective, I would highly recommend Reservation Dogs on FX.
A good show.
It's currently streaming on Hulu. It's fucking hilarious, and it plays with a lot of sort of Western iconography within its filmmaking. And if you are interested in more movies about the encroachment of capitalism on the American West, I would recommend pretty much everything directed by Kelly Reichardt, but especially her most recent film, First Cow.
I have not seen First Cow yet. Is it worth it? Yeah.
I like it quite a bit, but I adore Kelly Reichardt. I think I bring her up every other episode, so I'm not a biased opinion.
Reichardt stand like Raymond, and I can confirm it's pretty good.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, I did want to see it when I saw the trailer. So is it A24?
Yes.
Yeah, they're all A24, aren't they? They just sign me up. Just take my money. Okay, we'll go ahead and wrap it up there. Thank you so much for tuning in. I believe we're doing Power of the Dog next week. Is that right, Raymond?
I mean, that's what I keep hearing. Yeah.
That's what's been said in the hallways of Wisecrack corporate headquarters. When I go up to floor 6, the team there is talking about it. So.
Okay, well then we have to abide by the corporate overlord's rules. So we're doing Power of the Dog, I guess. Okay, so I believe it is also on Netflix. Isn't it on Netflix right now?
Netflix
I saw
original. It's a Netflix okay. movie, so it's presumably always going to be on Netflix.
Oh, I saw it at the Sydney Film Fest. So I saw it in the theater. So
this guy. Wow.
It was my first outing after
Mr.
the lockdown.
Mr. Jane Campion himself.
cool, but so it's on Netflix, so check that out. Make sure you catch up on that, I guess, ahead of time so that you can enjoy the chat with us while we're talking about it. Also, make sure to follow us on Twitter. It's SMTM_POD. That's SMTM_POD. You can also email us at movies@wisecrack.co, movies@wisecrack.co. Please do. We are going to have a mailbag segment here in the next, or I'm sorry, episode here in the next couple of weeks. Probably, what, maybe in the next 3 or so weeks, we should probably get into one of those. You can also call and leave us a voicemail at 1-213-534-8807. 1-213-534-8807. Check out Culture Binge. Michael, where can people find you on the internet other than Culture Binge?
Oh, and you know, sometimes we steal Raymond for Culture Binge too. He's a fan favorite. All the husbands love him. You can find me at Michael O'Burns on Twitter and something similar on Instagram, and Burns42069 on Letterboxd. Seems like a good podcast to mention Letterboxd.
Awesome. What about you, Raymond?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter and Letterboxd. I'm at Crematoria, and occasionally over on my friend Michael's podcast, Culture Binge. Just to say, they had a great episode this past week about NFTs.
We are NFT experts.
Yeah, and I'm really looking forward to the first Culture Binge NFT now.
I'm working on it right now. As of right now, it's an iPhone picture of me flicking off a picture of Margaret Thatcher.
Apparently, there's some dude that has been inventing philosophy concepts and turning them into NFTs. So
finally, the dream of Socrates realized in our very age. Philosophy consummated in its final form. World spirit is reunited with itself. I'm so happy. Sorry.
It is the truth. The capital T ecstatic truth. And if you want, you can find me Twitter, Austin_Hayden. I'm on Insta, AOS_HAY. I do a philosophy podcast called Owls at Dawn. We just did an episode on Station 11, which is my favorite series that I've seen in recent memory. And so Troy actually has read the book on that. I had not read the book, but we talk about the series. I freaking love it. So if you're a fan of the series, go check that out. If not, go check out the podcast because we do all kinds of shit. So yeah, anyway, send
really
us out of here, Raymond.
Goodbye from the final Texas Midlands branch in post.